Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. And thank you, as always, to our sponsors over at Markham Search. Markham Search offers premier professional recruiting services throughout the United States. Today, we have on our show Dr. Paustian. Dr. Anthony Paustian began his days as an Air Force in the Air Force on fighter aircraft, building national brands for companies like Rockwell Avionics and Miller Brewing. Dr. Paustian has decades of experience in strategic leadership. After developing a technology-focused college campus that was named one of the nation's most innovative organizations, Dr. Paustian created the college's annual Celebrate Innovation Week, also known as CI Week. It was the largest speaker-focused free event in the Midwest, and CI Week's sole purpose is to inspire. Dr. Paustian is the multi-award-winning author of A Quarter Million Steps and a podcast host of A Step Beyond through iHeartRadio. Dr. Paustian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Jennifer. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So tell our listeners a little bit about your history, how you went from being in the Air Force to helping companies brand themselves. How did you get into that field?
Well, much of it by pure accident, to be honest. I come from a generation where lots of kids grow up wanting to be astronauts. So I did my research as a kid, and I realized what I had to do to be an astronaut. And at that time, every astronaut was also a pilot, a fighter pilot. So I thought, okay, that's the path I'm going to take. So they were also all engineers. So in my research, I decided what I had to do. So I went through high school, got good grades, got an ROTC scholarship in the Air Force. I went to ROTC. I chose that versus the Air Force Academy because I decided I wanted to go to a good engineering school. First and foremost, to be an engineer and then fly after that, then hopefully get into the astronaut corps. Well, all that worked out great until I got into flight school and my vision took a little bit of a negative turn. And although I was still flying, and I still ended up flying as a pilot for F-111s, which, by the way, are all in museums now across the country. There are one or two places. They're in museums or they're all sitting out in the boneyard in Arizona rotting in the sun. But nonetheless, the aircraft has been long, long retired, and that dates me. But anyway, I stand about 6'3", and I was a little too tall to be an astronaut, apparently. So I got rejected a couple, two, three times from NASA for being too tall. So that kind of squashed that idea. And then when they retired my plane in the Air Force, they gave me some options. You know, I could retrain on a new aircraft. I could do a different job altogether. And I basically said, well, which option gets me into the private sector the fastest? So I took that option and got a job in Chicago. Working for a very large Fortune 1000 company as their VP of marketing because I had a strong marketing background as well. And worked that job for a few years and decided that I wanted to work for myself because I'm an entrepreneur at heart. So I left that job, opened up a firm in Iowa because that is where I am from originally. And I also opened up in Iowa because Rockwell Avionics, Rockwell Collins, big, big company that's heavy in the aviation industry, is in Iowa. And I secured them as one of my first clients. We did all of their GPS-related work. Back in the early 90s, GPS was just kind of coming out. It was a brand new thing. In fact, if you were a consumer and you had GPS, you were like one of those first people that had cell phones. it was state of the art. There were two different types of GPS back then. There was a military-grade GPS, you know, what they call a differential GPS, which got you within about 2 or 3 meters of where you were standing. It was pretty good. But then there was the commercial grade GPS, which is like, you know, if you had a boat or, you know, you were a company and you had to have GPS, you might get within a block or two. It wasn't very precise back then. And of course, now they have 7 times more satellites in orbit. They also have the assistance of all the cell towers as well. So between all that, they pretty much hone in pretty pinpointed close right where you're at, right where you're standing. But back in the early days of GPS, my firm did all the marketing work and all the brand development for Rockwell in that sector. And then we also took on other clients like Miller Brewing and a number of others as well. And I eventually sold that company, ironically enough, to Rockwell because they wanted to get internal. So then I was looking for another opportunity, and I was provided the opportunity to design and build a college campus from scratch, which was focused in technology, which I thought was a pretty cool sounding gig because not too often are you allowed to build a college the way you want to see it. And so I built the place. We became one of the nation's most innovative institutions, and I thought it was a 5-year gig, and yet I am still there. And I run the school. Yeah, I run the school. But in the meantime, while doing that, I also write a lot. Or I read a number of books, and I speak all over the country, and I have a podcast that I do just to inspire people, nothing more. In fact, everything I do now, my sole purpose is to inspire people. I want people to get out of their own little cocoons and their own little shells, and I want them to excel at whatever they want to excel at.
I love that. I think if we could all just get up every morning and say, gosh, who can I inspire today? We all might live a little bit happier lives. Because, you know, sometimes I feel like inspiration is a little bit dampened, unfortunately, for some people. I feel like we get out of bed and it's more rote, get up, have our cup of coffee or tea, walk the dog, get the kids off to school, whatever people do. And then that inspiration, that creativity is definitely missing. And I think that could make a difference for and give people the spark that's missing in some of their lives.
Absolutely. Yep. I'm a strong believer in getting out of your routine. If you drive the same way to work every day, every now and then drive a different way to work. Just change it up. Just do some different things. You'd be surprised at how that will change your entire chemistry of your mind.
Yeah. And I remember there was a program I had done a couple of years ago, and it was along those lines where they encouraged you to do everything one day completely differently. So if you drink your coffee with your right hand, drink it with your left hand, like you said, take a different route to work. And one of the most bizarre but interesting aspects of an exercise they had us do is they had us spend an hour at our house on the floor and observe everything from the perspective of the floor that was in the room. And again, it's just to get your brain outside of the normal way of thinking of just doing the same thing every way, every day. And it does spark creativity, and sometimes new thoughts and new ideas can come from it.
It's funny you bring up that exercise, because I've always told people that the biggest and easiest way to figure something out is to change your perspective. So, how many times have you dropped something on the floor and you can't find it, right? So something tiny. I've always said that, you know, the fastest way to find it is drop yourself to the floor, look at the carpet across the top of the carpet horizontally. You know, so instead of looking down on the carpet, get down on the floor, lay your head on the carpet, and look across horizontally, and the odds are that perspective will help you find it. It always works for me. I always find it that. But again, you got to change your perspective. See, my PhD is in psychology. I'm not a psychologist. I have to put that out there right now, because the reality is every time everybody hears me say that or finds that out, first thing they start doing is saying, well, you know, my wife and I have this. Okay, hold up there. I'm not a clinical psychologist. I have my own problems. But I do research a lot on creativity and imagination. So,
yeah. So tell me a little bit about that. I know one of the things that stuck with me is in our pre-show talk last week, we were talking about the intelligence quotient versus our creativity quotient. Can you elaborate on that a little bit for the people who are tuning in?
Yeah, I discussed this in my most recent book quite a bit too, because one of the things that I am passionate about, and the reason why I want to inspire people, is because people need to start to think differently. And to do that requires you to heighten your level of creativity. You know, we're all born creative. I'm sure everybody's heard this. You're born creative and you lose it over time because of rote memorization, school, you know, the way the schools operate, so on and so forth. And that's all true. But the problem, the most concerning thing to me, is that, you know, there are different ways to measure human intelligence. You've probably heard of the intelligence quotient, the IQ. You can measure IQ, and IQ is more about your ability to solve problems, your ability to think, you know, literally, mathematically, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's CQ, your creativity quotient. And CQ is your ability to make new connections. Honestly, I define creativity as nothing more than taking two things that already exist. I don't think there's anything out there that hasn't been discovered yet. We haven't discovered a new element in nature since 1939. That was francium, and it was found in little trace amounts. Every element we have in our periodic table since then has been a combination of two existing elements that, you know, that they force together. you know, they bombard lead with a form of radioisotope or whatever. So they create a new element. Well, that's what creativity is, taking two things that already exist and putting them together for the first time. So when FedEx was started, it was because of Fred Smith, the founder, who took the way the Federal Reserve System back in the old days used to clear and cancel checks written in banks all over the country, and he applied that towards the shipping industry, towards logistics, because he saw an opportunity to create a whole new paradigm within the logistics business, and hence FedEx was born, and overnight shipping was born, because prior to FedEx, overnight shipping didn't exist. Or Steve Jobs taking boring consumer electronics back in the day, where everything came in a tan or battleship gray box, and it was boring, ugly, and merging that with the fashion industry and to make consumer electronics cool and stylish. So thus people wanted them for a whole different reason besides just their functionality. I can go on all these examples like this, but that's what creativity is. Well, the creativity quotient measures that. And the studies that have been done recently in the last few decades found that while IQ scores have increased over time, and they have, our general average IQ score in this country has gone up over the last few decades. And it makes sense because more and more kids are playing video games all the time. And what is a video game? Well, it's a problem-solving exercise. You're constantly trying to solve problems within a maze, a puzzle. You're trying to get out of some battle sequence, whatever. It's trying to fix and solve a problem to win the game. That requires a certain degree of IQ. So we've been training kids to improve their IQs all along the way. But those games give you everything. There's no imagination there. I mean, they give you the entire environment, the entire existence within which you're working to solve this problem. You don't have to imagine anything. Like in the old days when I was a kid, we had to go outside and make everything. We had to imagine our entire environments. We had to make these fake this or fake that and make them out of cardboard boxes or whatever and pretend. Those days are gone. And because of that, over time, the CQ measurements have been declining. And one big measure of creativity in the world today is patent applications. Countries that have had the highest patent applications were always deemed to be the most creative. And the United States, honestly, has led that charge for many decades. Probably for the last 50, 60 years, the United States was number one in the world for patent filings every year, international patent filings. So all the great new ideas were coming out of the U.S. It didn't mean that Japan wouldn't see an idea that came out of the U.S. and innovate that idea, which they did frequently. Japan has been a great innovative country. And innovation is different creativity. Innovation is making an idea useful, whereas creativity is creating the idea in the first place. So, but we have been declining on patent applications. In fact, China is now leading the way on patent applications, followed closely by Japan, and we're now third in declining. Which is troubling to me because it's telling me that something's changing in our country, and the biggest thing that's changing, obviously, is creativity. IBM did a study where they went and surveyed well over 1,200 CEOs of major corporations all over the United States to find out what were the most highly sought-after attributes for employees, and by far and away, creativity and creative thinking was number one on the list. So they're seeing the need for it. And all you have to do is go to the bookstore. I mean, if you go to Barnes & Noble, you're going to see about 55,000 books on, becoming more creative, because that's the problem today. People aren't as creative as they used to be. So that's kind of what my charge is, to help you become more creative in their thinking.
Yeah, I think creativity, I can see where no matter what sort of position that you're in, and actually looking back throughout my career, having run a recruiting company and done recruiting for all different industries, I can see that the people who got promoted or the ones who had quicker success than others were the ones who were regularly coming up with creative solutions to problems. So you could have applicant A who goes into a position and starts at the same time as applicant B in a similar role. But what differentiates applicant A from applicant B is that he or she comes in and regularly approaches the executive team or whoever their manager is with solutions on how to make the company more effective, how to streamline, how to sell more, or just create new products or services. And I think out of that, that leads to innovation and that leads to further success. So I could see where creativity could actually lead to more money and greater productivity.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, companies live and die by what kind of products they create, what kind of services they create, how well they sell and or supply those services to the consumer, and how well they communicate and create experiences for those people. And the best ideas are the ones that typically help the companies be more successful. And the people who create those ideas are the ones who slide to the top almost always.
So tying into creativity, let's talk about coming up on the 50th anniversary of the first time that human beings orbited the moon. And I know next year we were saying is the 50th anniversary of when man walked on the moon. What role did creativity play in getting us to the moon?
Well, it's funny you should bring that up because my new book that just came out last October, it's called A Quarter Million Steps. And the book is honestly, it's a personal leadership book because my belief has always been that, and I deal with college students all the time. I deal with business industry all the time. I consult a lot. I speak a lot. And my premise has always been to be a good leader of others, you must be a good leader of yourself first. So the book kind of has a premise of self-leadership first and foremost. I talk a lot about organizational leadership, but the entire book is couched in creative thinking. And I use the metaphor in that book, the entire Apollo program, because what we did in 8.5 years during the 60s was nothing short of miraculous, especially if you look at it under today's microscope, because the amount of creative thinking, I would say the amount of orchestrated creativity, because there were over 400,000 people involved in that process. The amount of orchestrated creativity that was required to make that happen was extraordinary. I mean, and people kind of don't understand what the space program has done for this country, don't understand that or don't realize that, you know, there are over 6,000 products that we all take for granted each and every day of our lives that came right out of the Apollo research. I mean, and there are companies that were spun off out of this. Intel came out of the Apollo research. Can you imagine what our life would be like today without Intel and all the chips they create? So there are lots of great things that came out of the Apollo research that we just take for granted. You know, water purification, for example, bottled water, which would have been unheard of, people paying for that back in the day. But purified water is a big deal today, and that whole reverse osmosis process came out of the Apollo research. And I can go on and on. I mean, there are thousands and thousands of products. But more than that, that process inspired an entire generation. It inspired my generation to go on to become scientists, mathematicians, engineers, researchers, whatever. And because it was so extraordinary that everybody wanted to be an astronaut. Everybody wanted to do that. And it wasn't just that. At that particular time, we also had brand new science fiction on television that was mind-blowing compared to what we had prior to that with Star Trek, for example. Star Trek was mind-blowing when it came out in the 60s, and so much so it's become a cult thing, and it's grown and become a bigger thing ever since. But the imagination required to create that show by Gene Roddenberry inspired a lot of kids, too. So that generation was inspired, and that's the biggest thing that came out of the Apollo program, was the creative production of ideas that has changed all of our lives, along with the inspiration that it gave entire generations of kids. And my book, I wrote that book with that context in mind, because I happen to have I'm very lucky and fortunate to have this, but I have a professional and friend relationship with about half a dozen of the Apollo astronauts that's happened over time. It began many, many years ago, and it's kind of grown since then. In fact, the Apollo 15 astronaut, Alan Warden, who went to the moon in Apollo 15, wrote the foreword for my book. But having had the opportunity to talk to them firsthand at length and pick their brains and take a lot of the stories and a lot of the ideas they've had because they were there during all that, and then incorporate those into my book can kind of help me kind of go down that road, because it kind of forced the issue, because I could not help myself but do this after having talked to them.
And so what were some of the other characteristics? Obviously, creativity is a necessity when you're looking at becoming a leader. Were there any other characteristics out of your friendships with some of these astronauts who were part of the Apollo project that you would say stood out as far as leadership characteristics or qualities?
Well, absolutely. Teamwork was a big deal. I mean, one thing about NASA and Apollo back in the 60s is they understood the value of the doer. You know, in our culture today, all the big names, you know, the Elon Musks, the Steve Jobs, the Jeff Bezos, they get all the credit for everything that their companies do. We like to put these big leaders up on pedestals and in a way kind of worship them for what they do. And there's nothing wrong with that per se, but in reality, those three guys aren't doing much of the actual doing, so to speak. They might be the idea people, coming up with the big grand ideas and the direction the companies are going, but it's the people that work within the organizations, the doers, to get the job done. And NASA was very, very good about keeping the doers focused and keeping them working together strongly as a team. because without that teamwork, they were never going to get to the moon, especially in the short time frame they had. And like I said before, there were over 400,000 people. In fact, to tell you how massive this was in our country back then, if you take the 1969 census numbers of the workforce back then and look at the numbers who worked on Apollo in some way, one out of every 150 people in our country in some way worked on Apollo. That's massive. I mean, it's of a large magnitude. So NASA had to know how to make that all work together as a team and effective teams. And they did. They mastered that. And everybody knew their place. Everybody knew that they were all trying to accomplish the same end goal. You know, there's a piece of folklore. The reason why I say it's folklore is because even though I've heard it repeated 1,000 times, even that my Apollo astronaut friends even kind of repeat it, there's been no documentation anywhere to show that it actually happened. So it's maybe one of those urban legends that gets spread around. However, I will say, having talked to all these people and talked to mission control people and talked to the engineers who worked on it, this mindset did in fact exist throughout NASA. But there's a piece of folklore that JFK, John F. Kennedy, when he was walking and touring one of the NASA facilities, walked up to one of the custodians who was mopping the floor and asked him what all he did for NASA. And his response was simple and quick. He goes, I'm putting a man on the moon. Even though he was mopping a floor, he knew that his little part in this, his little insignificant role, as people would look at it, and keeping the place clean, was just as important to get a man on the moon as everybody else's was. They were all working towards one common purpose, one common goal. And that was a big deal. So teamwork was big. Work ethic was big. People realized that do this, they pretty much had to make a huge sacrifice. And many of them had to check out from their families for a few years just because they had to work so many hours. And they were so committed. You know, a good example was when Ken Mattingly, you saw the movie Apollo 13, he was played by Gary Sinise in that movie. Mm-hmm. Ken Mattingly, when Apollo 13 had its problem, its malfunction, its explosion, Ken Mattingly told me that at 3 a.m., only a handful of people were actually called in to start working that problem. But once everybody heard about it, everybody came in. He said at 3 a.m., he stepped out to take a break, and he stepped outside, and virtually down Houston Space Center, Johnson Space Center in Houston, every window of every building was on, and you could see heads in every window at 3 a.m. Everybody came in, whether they had to or not, and whether they had anything to offer, any insights, they still came in because they were committed to making sure that spacecraft got back safely. So the work, I think, was a big deal. They were all totally committed. They knew how to deal with change because they knew that the whole process was going to create massive change and at a rapid pace. So they were open to new ideas. They were open to changing things from the status quo. Nothing got squashed right away. And that was kind of the culture that existed within the entire time.
Wow. It's so funny that you don't see that same essence of camaraderie in today's society for, like you said, one out of every 150 Americans was working on the Apollo project. And I feel like at least in America, and I travel a lot around the world, but at least in America, you are just kind of a ship unto yourself. And that's the great thing. That's why people come here from all over the world, is that you can be your own ship, you can set sail. But for me, I remember the stark contrast when I was in Nepal last November building our first school. And for them in Nepal, everything was survival, was teamwork, like everything. You had 17 people who lived in a house, but one person cared for the younger children, one person cared for the older people in the house. And there was just this sense of community that, in my experience, in a lot of cultures, perhaps in certain parts of the United States, it still exists, but it just isn't as present culturally as a society or culturally within corporate America, at least in my opinion.
No, honestly, we haven't really had that kind of, all-in group mindset since World War II, prior to that, when our entire country was working in some way for the war effort. So, yeah, that was the next big thing that our entire country was working towards. And to be honest, that the first time we landed a man on the moon, like you said, the 50th anniversary is coming up next July, a year from now. And that one aspect, that one success, so to speak, that we had as a country actually united the world for a brief moment. I mean, the entire world was united behind that. So it does show that there are things that can happen that will unite us as an entire world, regardless of division. We were all united during that.
So how, Dr. Pastian, how do we as individuals either create that in the culture of our own companies or create that in our own world? Is that something that you can create without some, you know, force, some movable force, like a war, like getting to the moon? Is there a way to generate that within yourself?
Well, I do believe it starts top down. Culture begins with, you know, with who is leading that culture. And in all honesty, you know, but when I lead, you know, everybody's different. You know, I came out of the military, so I had this whole military mindset ingrained into me in terms of, you know, rank and chain of command and structure. And, you know, you never went over your commander. But that doesn't work in the corporate world. It really doesn't. It works great in the military, and I can understand why the military has to have it that way. But in the corporate world, it really doesn't work. So I actually kind of function very opposite how I was in the military. Like, for instance, I have a very open door policy. My doors are always open. People are encouraged to come in and talk to me anytime they have an idea or a thought, a problem, you know, whatever the case might be. I do ask people to have a solution for that problem before they come in my door. Or if they want to just make me aware of something, that's fine. But I don't want them to sit there and complain about it. I mean, I want them to have an idea how we're going to fix it. And but the other thing I try to encourage people is, listen, just be honest and open. I mean, the reality is I'm okay if you can't do something or if you're going to miss that deadline or something's going to create a problem because of this, this, and this. But just tell me about it. I mean, I can't help you fix it or I can't do anything about it after the fact. I need to know about it beforehand so we can address it. So don't just come in and tell me what you think I want to hear as a leader. Just tell me the truth and be honest with me. And that starts from top down, because a lot of times I think today's workforces, subordinates, to use that word, so to speak, are afraid to tell their supervisors the truth and be brutally honest about it. So I want to create that kind of a culture in whatever workplace I'm at, where people can be honest with another, people can share ideas with one another. There's not rebuke. There's not people getting discouraged or shot down because of people's responses, that we're all very, very open to things. But the reality is, at some point, you got to pull a trigger on an idea and move forward. And that's where the leader has to say, okay, I appreciate all your input. I appreciate all your ideas. But ultimately, I'm responsible to get this thing done. And the buck stops with me, and I'm accountable for it. So I think we're going to go down this path. And then people just need to support that. But you got to give them all the opportunities to be part of that process before you actually pull the trigger on something.
Yeah, I agree. And I was just reading a great article the other day about the fear that people have, and as you said, as subordinates, if they're in a role where they might go into a leadership meeting or an executive meeting, and they're afraid to express their opinion and afraid that what if their opinion's wrong or what if they say the wrong thing. And so one thing that perhaps people could do in order to kind of create more of that camaraderie, even if you're not in a leadership position, is just get curious and ask for an invitation. If somebody doesn't specifically say in a meeting, what are your thoughts on this, to just ask and ask an open-ended curious question and say, hey, are you open to thinking about this? What if we did X, or how would you feel about Y? I think where people get themselves in trouble, NASA, government, the army, or in the private sector, is where people demand things or say it should be this way or it should be that way, as opposed to, like you said from the beginning, coming to the table with creative solutions and asking, what if? I wonder, could it go this way? How about this? And I think that's where you can actually come up with solutions that people might not have otherwise thought of.
Well, I will be honest to say that when I was first hired to build my campus, I was not a popular guy in the college. You know, the college I'm part of is a very large institution, and, you know, we've got 6 campuses and a whole ton of different learning centers, and we have about 50,000 students in our system, and it's a big school. And so when I came in, I came from the military private sector, so I wasn't an entrenched academic per se. So I was looking at solving this problem from a very, you know, practical, let's do what's best, let's do what's right, and let's do what's coming. In other words, let's think about where education is going to be 10, 20 years from now and not where we're at today, because by the time, you know, we get running full forward here, we're going to be hitting that wall sooner versus later. So we were very forward thinking. And of course, when you start to do forward thinking activities and you start to change things, people don't always like change. And I wasn't the most popular guy, let's just put it that way, within the other campuses and the other institutions. But ironically, it all worked great in the previous institution, and they all came on board eventually, but it took some time. So sometimes the best thing for an institution, I'm convinced, is a good change agent to come in and kind of shake things up a little bit away from the status quo, because the status quo is a killer long term, I'm convinced of it.
So tell me, it's funny, I don't know if you'll be able to confirm this story. When you started talking about the lore and the folklore about the story of JFK, I hadn't heard that one before, but there was another story I've heard throughout the years about the Apollo Project. And it was something to the effect of, you have all these scientists who are in a room, and they all had a very, very similar background. So for months, they're working on trying to solve this problem of how do we get ourselves to the moon? And then finally, one day, somebody came in with a creative idea and said, hey, maybe we should bring people into this room who think completely differently than us and see what ideas they bring to the table. And that it was only a month after that that they had come up with a solution of how to get us to the moon. I don't know if that's a lore or a folktale as well, or if that actually happened. Only your astronaut friends would probably know.
That's actually true. And my friend Al Bean, who recently passed away, he walked on the moon in Apollo 12, which also has its 50th anniversary next year as well, because he landed on the moon in November of 1969. Al Bean would often tell the story that, you know, when he was asked to be part of the astronaut corps, and he came into this big, large room full of people, and you know, he had an engineering background, but you know, he was an Air Force, he was a Navy pilot, and he didn't know anything about going to the moon or being an astronaut. So he was expecting to sit down in this big room and have all these brilliant minds to tell him how it was going to be. And he goes, wow, I realized pretty fast that nobody knew what they were doing and we were in trouble. And he said, but amazingly, when you get a bunch of average people together who know how to work together as a group and who are respectful from one another, you'd be surprised at the synergy that can develop from a lot of average people's thinking into some great ideas. And in that room were people from other disciplines and other backgrounds. And I'll be honest, it's still happening today. For example, I was asked to participate in the annual Space Settlement Conference out in L.A., may I add. And this is a part of the National Space Society where they start talking about the future, that someday human beings will settle on another world. They'll be the moon or Mars or somewhere else. And they want people to discuss this, not just from NASA and JPL and engineers and so on and so forth. They want people from other walks of life, say like myself as an educator or whatever, to discuss this from a different perspective. And so that's still happening because there is value in bringing diverse opinions together because they all see it from a different perspective. And I go back to what I said, you know, 20 minutes ago, that perspective, a change of perspective is huge from a creative perspective.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that because from a hiring perspective, I remember somebody who I hired probably 2 to 3 years ago, and you don't even mean to do this, but as a leader or a manager, sometimes you hire people who have a similar personality or think in a similar way that you do. And I remember I had hired somebody who was completely divergent from me in the way that we thought. She was extremely analytical, very organized, very thorough, and I'm more of the 100,000-foot view, big picture sort of a person. And I remember when she joined the team and she started going, oh, have you thought about doing it this way? Oh, have you considered that? And she was constantly coming up with solutions to problems that we weren't even aware of. And it became extremely evident. It was a lot of fun. About 2 years ago, I took my team of recruiters to an escape room. And what was really great is that you were able to see how if you put 5 or 6 people in a room, who one person might be good at math, another person might be better at analytical things, somebody else might be better at words. And as you put these brains together, it was phenomenal just to see the camaraderie and the teamwork of each individual and how they were able to contribute. And since then, it's caused me to think differently about hiring. Instead of just trying to hire a bunch of mini-me's, which I had somebody on the show actually probably about 6 months ago talking about diversity and how that prevents diversity in the workplace, that if you're able to think outside of the box and hire people who might kind of push you up against some of the boundaries of what you're comfortable with, whether it's thinking outside of the norm, et cetera, it actually can create great innovation and creativity in the workplace.
Yeah, I'll tell you two things. I'm with you. When I was hiring my number one, so to speak, my Commander Riker, if you're a Star Trek fan, my second in command, when I was hiring that person, honestly, initially, my gut liked the person that was just like me. I mean, because I was initially drawn to that person because he was just like me. But after giving it a lot of thought, I realized, you know what? I need somebody who's not just like me. I need somebody who can execute an idea, not just have an idea. So I hired a guy who's now been with me for 17 years that is very polar different from me. He's not a real like, big idea guy, but he's an incredible executor. I mean, and he can, when I give him a task, he gets it done, and he gets it done fast and efficiently, and knows how to put rubber to the road and execute an idea. And he's been just my most valued asset for the last almost 20 years. So that is an important aspect to have, bring teams together of people that work well together, that bring different skills and tools to the table that can work well with one another. The other thing you mentioned a second ago about out of the box, I got to tell you, I personally hate the phrase, we got to think out of the box. Because I'm a believer that, well, I mean, let me tell you why. I'm a believer that thinking out of the box is what's gotten our country and people into problems, because we get, you know, because I think at some point you gotta rely on what you value. And as whether it's a country or a company or an individual, your core values are what are who you are, and they drive you. Well, when you get out of the box, so to speak, and you get too far away from that box, you lose touch with what's important and what really matters. And I think that's what's gotten us into trouble, or companies in trouble, or the country's in trouble, or people in trouble, because they get too far away from that box of who you really are. So my belief is just kind of a little bit different than that. My belief is you shouldn't get out of the box per se. You need to keep a leg in it, but what you need to do is get a bigger box, increase your box. And no, seriously, because if you go back to my point on creativity is making connections, the problem is, it's not so much your ability to get out of your own little world, your own little box, so to speak. The problem is, do you have enough information in your head to make those connections? Because it implies that for you to connect something, like for FedEx to connect the Federal Reserve System and how it clears checks to a new solution for logistics and shipping, he had to know about the Federal Reserve System. He had to understand how that worked, and he had learned that in school. Well, the problem today is people aren't taking the time to learn things anymore, because the mindset is, well, I got Google. I'll just Google if I want to learn it, right? If I need to do something, I'll just Google on my smartphone. Well, that doesn't help you from a creativity perspective. So I always encourage people to expand their boxes, to learn things they would never, ever, in a million years, ever have a need to learn or want to learn, but they learn them nonetheless, because you never know when something you see something, because it's happened to me numerous times in my life. I see something in a totally different context, totally out of my sphere of knowledge base, and realize, wow, I can reapply that in a different context, and now I have something totally new. And it happens all the time. So I encourage people to watch Discovery Channel, to watch, you know, History, Travel Channel, whatever on TV, to go experience new things, to travel, to do all kinds of things, to gain those new experiences, to learn those new things, because that by itself will make them better creative thinkers, because they'll have more to connect in their minds as they try to solve problems.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I think it's not, like you said, about getting out of the box. It's about expanding the box, or maybe moving the shape of the box and shifting the box. So I like where you're going with that.
Well, Dr. Make it bigger.
Make it bigger. Bigger could be better if it gives you more room for creative thought. So Dr. Poskian, we could obviously talk all day about this and about your amazing new book, A Quarter of a Million Steps, but tell me, are there any points that I didn't cover or anything that you would love to leave our listeners with today from today's show that we didn't get a chance to cover already, or any points that you would love people to remember?
Well, the biggest thing is, I want people to understand that, you know, that I hear a lot of people say the following thing: I'm not a very creative person. Because they associate in their mind creativity as being something artistic, or musical, or whatever the case might be, something visual. That's not creativity. Creativity is nothing more than, I said, you know, than what I said before, making new connections between things that already exist. So anybody can be creative. It just takes practice, and practice makes permanent. It doesn't make perfect. It makes permanent. The more you do something, the more permanent that behavior becomes, because, you know, habits. We all have habits. Well, they're habits because you've repeated that behavior so many times that it's become second nature. You don't think twice about it. You just do it. So, you know, I would encourage people to get out there and practice being creative. You know, and one of the things that I do in my book all, you know, frequently throughout is I've got a number of, at the end of each chapter, I have a number of exercises and things for people to go try and try new, where it forces us to look at things from a different perspective. And you just do one thing at a time. I mean, you know, you don't go out there and try to change your entire mindset overnight. You just practice one thing. Case in point, you know, everybody talks about dreams a lot, how, you know, psychologists have thought for years that dreams were, you know, an indicator of the future or, you know, some sort of a, regardless of what dreams may or may not be, what I do believe is that your dream state is your subconscious. And when you try to solve a problem and you can't, and you walk away from that problem, your subconscious is 24/7 and it's still working that problem. That's why you get those aha experiences. Become out of the blue, because consciously you've gone on to something totally different, but your subconscious is still working the problem and it solves it, you know, and that's why out of the blue you get the solution. Well, your dream state is your subconscious state. So here's a little exercise. Some of my personal best ideas have come from dreams. And I will tell you that people always say, well, I can't remember my dreams. I have no recollection of what I dreamed like before. I can't remember it or whatever the case might be. But you can train your brain to do this. It's kind of like when you get up at the same time every morning, your alarm goes off, say at 6 a.m., and you find yourself waking up at 5:45 or 5:50 on your own, because subconsciously your brain's got a clock, and it just knows it's time, and it wakes you up. So you can train your brain. If you do this every time you wake from bed, regardless of what time it is or when or whatever, and you have a piece of paper and a pencil, and you try to, and you write down everything you can remember, every fragment or everything you can remember from your dreams that you had the night before, and do that every day for a period of time. Now, for some people, it won't take them long. Others take longer. It varies on the person. But you will get to the point where you have trained your brain to become aware of what you dreamt the night before, so you can write it down in the morning. So you can remember it better. And next thing you know, you'll start to remember things that ideas that were actually solutions to problems that your subconscious was still solving without even realizing it. And you'll find some great ideas that come out of that, because like I said, your subconscious is still solving a problem, and that problem solution may have that aha experience in a dream because you're sound asleep. So you'd be surprised what you can get from that. So that's just one little tidbit of an exercise that you can do. But like I said, my book's got tons of those at the end of each chapter to practice and try, because it's all about practice. The more you practice, the better thinker you'll be.
I love that. So tell people, where can they find the book? Should they find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble? Is there another website you'd like people to go to?
Well, I'm going to give all your listeners a tip here. Yes, you can get my book through any bookstore. But I will tell you that if you order it from the website, that's the only place you can get the book, and it's the same exact price as it costs at a bookstore. So it's the same price as Barnes & Noble or anywhere else. But if you order it through quartermillionsteps.com, that's just, you know, just how it sounds, quartermillionsteps.com. If you order through quartermillionsteps.com, it comes signed not only by me, but it comes signed by an Apollo astronaut. Apollo astronaut L.
No
Warden.
No kidding.
Apollo. Yeah,
that's comes, amazing.
Yeah, he has signed them too. So it comes signed by both of us and at the same price. So that's a little tip that I'll give for all your listeners, that if you want to get a signed copy by an Apollo astronaut. And I got to be honest with you, it's sad, but not going to be around with this a whole lot longer, because, you know, they're aging, and this is a good, great way to get a piece of lifetime memorabilia for your friends or indoor family. So, I don't necessarily advertise that per se. If you go to the website, you'll see it, but yeah, I would say if you want a piece of history, yeah, go there and get it. I mean, you're free to get it at any bookstore, but quartermillionsteps.com is the best place to get it.
That is amazing. Well, I know what I'm getting my husband, brother-in-law, and dad for Christmas. So that is awesome, Dr. Poskin. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you so much to everybody who's tuning in out there. Do remember that if you missed any portion of today's show, you can find it immediately after the show on the LA Talk Radio website on the Get Yourself the Job page in the archive section at the bottom. Additionally, the show will be available later in the week on iTunes under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. We invite you to subscribe, listen at your leisure, and also leave us any comments or feedback that you might have about the show. And tune in next week. We have Rhonda Vater, who is president of NThrive. Previously, she was the CTO of Estee Lauder. And we will be continuing the discussion about leadership and what it takes to be a leader in today's society. So thank you again, Dr. Postian, for joining us today. And I know what I'm doing after the show. I'm going to go buy a couple of copies of the book for gifts. So thank you again for sharing that wonderful tidbit with us.
Thank you for having me. And I might just throw out one thing that I mentioned before at the beginning. I have a podcast. It's called The Step Beyond. It's through iHeartRadio. And I interview Apollo astronauts, cast members from Mythbusters, Star Trek actors, all kinds of people like that. So, and again, my podcast is the same thing that everything else I do is just to inspire people. So there's some great stories in there.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, I will have to download a couple of those episodes myself. And again, thank you for all the wonderful and value that you added and inspiration today, Dr. Postian.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. Wishing everybody a wonderful week.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.